I'm Hakan Özoğlu, Associate Professor of History, and you are listening to The Riches Documentary Podcast. Welcome to The Riches Documentary Podcast. RICHES, the regional initiative for collecting the histories, experiences, and stories of Central Florida, is an umbrella program housing interdisciplinary public history projects that bring together different departments at the University of Central Florida with profit and nonprofit sectors of the community in order to promote the collection and preservation of region's history. By facilitating research that records and presents the stories of communities, businesses, and institutions in Central Florida, RICHES seeks to provide the region with a deeper sense of its heritage. This series will feature a podcast every 2 weeks, in the middle and at the end of each month, that will explore various aspects of Central Florida history. In today's episode, Huntington Island State Park, King Hosbrook speaks with two archaeologists and two park rangers about what the archaeology at the park tells us about the society and culture on the island in the last 7,000 years.
Hi, I'm Kim Hosbrook. Welcome to this podcast about the history of Huntington Island State Park. Long before Huntington Island State Park became a state-owned area for recreation, it was a home to Native Americans, a pioneer homestead, an orange packing plant, and a boat works. This podcast will focus on the rich archaeological assets of what is now Huntington Island State Park. Of course, the island also has an interesting recent history, and the podcast will look at that as well. Most people probably think of Egypt or King Tut's tomb when archaeology is mentioned, but the United States has some rich archaeological sites of its own. This may bring to mind the Native American mounds in the Midwest and Mississippi. Florida also has mounds, including some very significant examples along the St. Johns River. Mounds are a very important part of the landscape at Huntington Island. To learn more about U.S., and more specifically, Florida archaeology, I spoke with George Long. Mr. Long is an instructor in the anthropology department at the University of Central Florida who specializes in archaeology. Native American mounds in Florida yield many treasures for archaeologists. Mr. Long explains the basics of Florida mounds.
The three main types would be conical burial mounds. These would be earth mounds, which have burials in them. There are also earth mounds that are ceremonial mounds, which are normally flat top with ramps leading up to them. These are rare, found more in the northern part of the state. And then there are what archaeologists call midden mounds that are consist of refuge. These are most often in Florida shell mounds, where you've had people living by the saltwater lagoons or the freshwater rivers, dropping the shellfish underfoot until they pile up and become very substantial. There's a variety of other variations. Some of the middens, of course, are very small, scattered, called sheet midden. Some are large, big as a house. In southwest Florida, you have large shell middens, but some of the midden material, the shell refuge, has been reshaped into ceremonial mounds and causeways. Down in South Florida near Lake Okeechobee, for instance, there are some interesting earthworks there where you have lineal ditches and embankments and circular patterns also, which are either for drainage or some argument about it or for ceremonial uses.
For those who may be wondering exactly what a midden is, U.S. Park Service Ranger Craig Morris from the Timaquan Preserve in Jacksonville offered a great layman's definition. The Timaquan Preserve is home to one of the more famous archaeological finds from a midden near Huntington Island, the Huntington Island Owl Totem.
Midden is a fancy word for garbage site, but middens aren't just garbage dumps. They're extremely valuable. These shell deposits, these garbage sites, when you go through them, you go through the evidence of the people who were living at the time. Much like if somebody were to go into a landfill, they could learn things about our cultures.
Mr. Long also compared Florida's mounds and middens to those in other parts of the country and discussed who built the mounds and when they built them.
In general, the archaeology in Florida, the artifacts, the mounds, they all fit into a bigger picture. The burial mounds, for instance, that you find in Florida very often show obvious connections with perhaps the Hope Welling or tradition throughout the eastern United States or most of the eastern United States. some of the what we call flat-top temple mounds in the Tallahassee area particularly. I'm thinking there's a very famous site there called Lake Jackson. They have flat-top, what we call Mississippian mounds there. And these obviously stem from influences from the Midwest and the Mississippi area. The general patterns that you find in the mounds, as you go from no mounds to maybe burial mounds and then more complex burial mounds and eventually very large ceremonial mounds, follow trends that are spread out through the whole eastern United States. So they are related. Mounds have been intensively studied ever since the 1800s in Florida and in other areas. And there's a established a chronology, mainly looking at the artifacts, pottery, for instance. We recognize different styles of pottery decoration and the way it's made and have pretty well defined particular chronological or archaeological periods in Florida. So most of the mounds have been dated according to the archaeological period, so there's no problem there. And the differences are great as you go from one archaeological period to another, a cultural period. At one point we had, during the what we call the Paleo-Indian period in Florida, we have essentially no burial mounds, and probably not a large amount of what we call midden mounds. During the Archaic period, you had, well, for instance, at Wendover, a very important site in Titusville, you had burials that were submerged in a pond. During the next period, which we, in this area of Florida, anyway, the St. John's, one, for instance, you would have some burial mounds. And then towards the historic periods, in some places, sometimes you would have the Mississippian-influenced temple mounds. So they vary by period, and they also vary by location. And this might also have to do with cultural influences. The cultural influences, for instance, of the late prehistoric peoples, the Mississippian culture, we'll say, did not reach, right, say, to the further southern tip of Florida. It seemed to have more influence in the northern areas. And then, of course, there's the material also that's available that's going to have an influence. So the archaeologists know a lot about the periods that are involved.
To see how Hontoon Island's mounds and middens fit into both Florida and U.S. archaeology, I spoke with Professor Kenneth Sassaman, the Hyatt and C.C. Brown Professor of Archaeology in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Florida. Professor Sassaman has participated in 5 summer field schools in the Middle St. Johns River area, with quite a bit of that time spent at Hontoon Island.
There's 2 basic kinds of mounds in the region. There's the linear ridges that quite often have a little bit of a curvature to them. So we call them, you know, crescent-shaped or semicircular. The one at the south end of Hontoon is about 120 meters. So those are the oldest. Those are the ones that date between 7,000 and 5,500 years ago. Now, the other major form is much larger and later in time. And that's the big U-shaped constructions or accumulations that can be as large as a small football stadium. So the one that we know best is actually on the southwest end of Lake George to the north of Hontoon Island, the largest shell deposit of all of northeast Florida, 300 meters long, a couple hundred meters wide, 8 to 9 meters tall, and in a U-shaped configuration that you could describe as an amphitheater. The north end of Hontoon Island has a deposit that rivals that one in size. What we know about their dating is limited, but what we think we know about these things is that as we see them in the modern era as big U-shaped constructions, roughly about 4,000 years ago, coincident with the introduction of the very first pottery in the region. And we believe that, known as orange fiber timber pottery, we believe that type of pottery originates from the coast. Not coincidentally, the coast at this time is the haven for populations that accumulated shell in rings. The rings of Florida are quite large and are pretty close renditions of the ones that we see in the Middle St. John's. So it's not a stretch of the imagination, looking at the pottery, looking at the configuration of the shell constructions and so forth, to make the argument that the Middle St. John's people, including those at Hontoon Island, had these coastal, either coastal origins or coastal alliances that would have connected them up with people that brought these influences, either literally by immigrating into the region or just through trade and word of mouth and so forth, these ideas for constructing these monuments and using pottery and so forth.
Archaeology digs usually bring to mind treasure and riches, or at least ancient artifacts. The actual finds may not sound so exciting to the rest of us, but archaeologists can learn a great deal from simple, everyday items or even the materials layered to form the mounds.
And our work at Hantoon has involved a lot of things, but our most significant work has been at that smaller mound at the south end of the island, because our work has shown that it actually is one of the oldest monuments constructed in North America. Dates as early as 6,500, perhaps 7,000 years ago. And we found out recently through radiocarbon dating of the samples we retrieved over the years that it actually went up quite quickly, perhaps as little as two or three generations, 6,000 years ago. So it's significant for that reason alone. It's a relatively recent discovery. It puts Hantoon on the map as one of the locations of the oldest monuments constructed in North America. And it adds greater time depth than we've ever seen at the island before. Up until this point, I think that the assumption was that most of the mounds, certainly the one at the north end of the island and perhaps even the one at the south, was interpreted as being a relatively late construction. If you go to Hantoon today, they still have a sign that indicates that the mounds and the sites on the island were left there by ancestors of the Tamukwa. And that's something that we could debate. It's not clear that there's a direct connection with those historic people, but clearly when you push the archaeology back 6,000 or 7,000 years, those direct lines fade away, and we're looking at a much greater record of diversity in cultural identities, and clearly Hantoon has much of that, much more than we've ever expected.
Professor Sassaman also talked about what archaeologists have learned about the people who lived on Hantoon Island through their work at the mounds and middens.
We have evidence of more or less continuous occupation of Hantoon Island until European contact. But I say more or less because we do not have sufficient evidence to suggest that there weren't long periods of abandonment of the island. We do know between about 7,000 and I'd say 5,500, there was fairly intensive activity on the island. We also know that between about 4,500 years ago and about 3,800 years ago, there was another very intensive period of activity. And then thereafter, it gets to be more cryptic because much of the evidence of later prehistory was carted away when the largest shell mound at the north end of the island was mined for, aggregate that was used for the roads and other constructions in Volusia County. So it's been truncated, but we do know from limited campsites on the island and from anecdotal evidence that there was a very intensive occupation that would have dated to about 2,500 years ago, maybe to 2,000, and then ultimately the work that Barbara Purdy did back in the 1980s in the lagoon just to the northeast of the big shell mound, right to the east of the island itself in Lake Beardsford, has an archaeological deposit that's very late, the couple of centuries right before European occupation, and it does continue into the European era and seems to have ended sometime perhaps in the 17th, perhaps the late 16th century.
Professor Sassaman mentioned damage to the mounds from mining. I asked him about that damage as well as other dangers to the mounds. People can have a tremendous impact on the mounds and the historical records that can be found there.
The commercial mining that started in earnest in the earlier part of the last century has all but eliminated the above ground components of shell mounds in Northeast Florida. There's actually very few of them left that are unmolested. So it destroyed those records. I mean, and that is really, it's a frightful thing, and it is really disheartening. But I'm an optimist, and I've always been an optimist about what you can extract from sites that have been badly impacted. So going to these sites, what we found out pretty quickly was, the mining removed all the above-ground shell. That's what they were after. But as soon as they hit either the water table or, in the case of many of these mounds, they hit a layer of concreted shell that's actually cemented together like concrete. And once they hit either the water or the concreted shell, they stopped. Well, they actually stopped well before they hit the bottom. The reason why they hit the water now is because water levels are higher than they were when the sites were initiated as deposits of shell. So there could be as much as a meter, a meter and a half, in some cases maybe even over 2 meters of shell that had accumulated before water levels came up to the point where the mining operation couldn't penetrate any further. So that, again, is something that preserves the basal part of these mounds. So the bottom line is truly the bottom part of these mounds is still intact, and that's actually of great interest to us because our questions have been primarily what are the conditions and circumstances under which this early shell mounding occurred. So we're interested in the origins issues, and that's still preserved there. It's tough to excavate if you're below the water table or underneath this concreted stuff. It takes a lot of patience and good technology to do it, but it is doable, and so we've been able to do a little of that. Now, aside from that, mining operations often left, they would leave, as they did at the north end of Pontoon Island, little perimeter berms of shell that still mark essentially the outer limits of the shell deposit. I don't know why they did that. It may have been in some cases required by, I don't think required by law, but it may have been required by the sensibilities of the landowners that they not level it completely. And it may have been also a matter of hydraulic engineering that if they took it all out, they were creating conditions that would have backflooded the areas that they were trying to mine. So they left these up essentially as like levees. So what we've been doing, we did this at Hontoon, we've done it at other places as well. We take advantage of these mining escarpments by cleaning the faces of them off straight and then recording the profiles and then going down below that into the substrate until we hit the water or the concreted stuff ourselves. So there's actually a lot of potential just in looking at the cuts that were left behind by the mining. And occasionally I've got to remind myself that had some of these sites not been mined, there wouldn't be exposures available to take a look at today. But it's the ethic of modern archaeology, not to dig unless you have to. And so by doing it the way we do it, we minimize the amount of additional impact, maximize the amount of exposure, and maximize the amount of information that we can get out without any further damage. Pontoon Island, fortunately, is under protection of the Department of State and the state park system. So as long as it's been under their jurisdiction, any looting that was going on there has been pretty much curtailed, perhaps even entirely erased. In the years that we worked there for 5 years between 2000 and 2005, never once did I see an example of looting on Hontoon Island. So I think, for the most part, those sites are safe thanks to the state's interest in maintaining them as parks.
While most of the damage to the mounds is attributable to humans, some is caused by nature. Of course, people can still try to protect the mounds from natural processes.
By and large, I'd say that it's not that unusual. I mean, tree tip-ups occur with or without hurricanes. Trees die, they fall down. Erosion occurs from all sorts of natural processes. So these sites they're being affected, of course. Eventually, given enough time, they may be so fully compromised as to be without any significant new scientific information. But that's going to be a long time. I think that, by and large, the best thing to do with sites is to ensure that they're protected from us, from people, ensure that they're not subject to other natural insults because of modifications to the landscape. It's one thing for a hurricane to come through and knock down a few trees and take out, you know, some of the sediment of a mound. And it's another thing for something that to come through and do more damage simply because, you know, we denuded the landscape of vegetation. So, you know, again, the state parks does a great job of being, you know, good stewards of the land. They don't clear vegetation unless absolutely necessary. They try to maintain ecosystem balance there and monitor the conditions. So, you know, I think it's a really nice thing that they have that. I'm really grateful that one of the last mounds standing in Northeast Florida is residing in a state park.
There's comparatively recent history on the island as well. I spoke with Cheryl Potts, a state park ranger at Hontoon Island State Park, about some of the significant events and people associated with the island.
In 1840, there was a Seminole war soldier, last name of Hontoon, who had acquired the land, the property to establish a pioneer settlement. After that, in 1888, the Drecker family owned a part of the island as well and built a small orange packing house on here. They used it for transporting oranges and to Jacksonville and elsewhere from the Grove. An undercover federal agent by the name of Hotbin converted the packing house. He was here doing surveillance on crime in Deland, and he was stationed here on the island. After he caught pneumonia, he decided he was going to stay here. And then he converted the small orange packing house into boat works and did work on boats out here as well. The owl effigy that was found in 1955 in our parking lot, that's a pretty significant find here. It's pretty much the largest and most intact totem found on the East Coast that I know of. I haven't heard of or seen of anything bigger around, especially in Florida. With the state acquired the property in 1967, opened to the public in 1970. And in 1977, they found two more effigies, the large pelican, which we have a replica in the museum, and the small otter, which is out in the yard.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast about the history of Hantu Island State Park. If you found it interesting, please join me for the companion podcast about the Hantu Island totems. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Riches Documentary Podcast. Feel free to contact us with any questions or comments on the program that you just heard. Please join us for the next episode, The Parliament House, Pioneering Gay Establishment of Central Florida.